From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After 5 years of often terrible civil war in Syria, the last week has seen some of the very worst in Aleppo. The country's largest city has been pounded from the skies. Today, a fierce ground assault is said to be underway. There are charges of barbarism and war crimes. This hour on Point, the thrashing of Aleppo. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you watching what is happening in Syria? The Russians, the Syrians, the U.S., and more. What should be done? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at the life and legacy of former Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres, who has died in Tel Aviv at 93. But first, Syria. Terrible scenes in the last 5 days and more now since the ceasefire there ended. Here is Fatma al-Musa telling Al Jazeera her son, among many others, was killed instantly during an airstrike in Aleppo over the weekend. Her granddaughter survived after doctors took 6 pieces of shrapnel from her stomach.
My son was killed in the attack. His 3 children were playing outside and were injured. We pray to God for peace. We can't take this anymore.
Bunker busting, bombs and more on Tuesday. In another report for Al Jazeera, journalist Amr Al-Halabi reported on the chaotic scene at an Aleppo hospital after one of those, just one of those airstrikes.
Here in one of the makeshift hospitals, dozens of bodies outside the hospital and dozens of injured people inside. Dead people are on the floor of this makeshift hospital. The situation here is desperate.
Lots of condemnation from all over. What does it amount to? Here was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon earlier this week saying the use of bunker-busting bombs is going straight at civilians now.
These bombs are not busting bunkers. They are demolishing ordinary people looking for any last refuge of safety. International law is clear. The systematic use of indiscriminate weapons in densely populated area is a war crime.
Aleppo described as a living hell, maybe a dying hell right now. Joining us from Beirut, Lebanon today via Skype is Liz Sly, Beirut bureau chief for the Washington Post. She's been covering Syria for a long time now. Liz Sly, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
What's the latest from Aleppo? We're reading here reports of a ground assault underway as well. Now, who's going after what and how?
Well, basically, as you said in your introduction, since last week, the Syrian government has launched a huge offensive to try and recapture the rebel-controlled eastern half of the city, which fell under rebel control 4 years ago. They have begun this with the most ferocious, intense airstrikes, as you were describing. And this has really turned into a nightmare for the people there because they can't escape. The city is the rebel-held part of the city is completely surrounded. Now, that has been accompanied by some small pushes across the front line, which sort of zigzags through the center of the city between the rebel-held and the government-controlled halves. And there have been some attempts to push through on that front, but I'm not sure we're seeing what some are describing as the full-scale ground assault that we might one day have when they decide the time is right to actually try and surge into these areas.
Liz, who is doing the bombing, and what kind of bombs are being used?
Well, these are Syrian warplanes and also Russian warplanes. There's been plenty of photographs showing that both of those kinds are being used. And one of the more alarming things we've seen is this introduction of these bunker-busting bombs. But really, you know, the bombs, all of the bombs are terrible. They're hitting, they hit a bakery very early this morning. They hit 2 hospitals this morning. They're deliberately going after targets that sustain life there to make it harder for people to survive and get by. And they're dropping huge bombs randomly on buildings and bringing the whole buildings down on top of people.
We're talking about sometimes 100 and more dying in a given day. And we're in the fifth or more day now of this now.
Yes, that's right. Certainly over the weekend. The weekend was probably the worst we've seen so far. There were well over 100 people on 2 days there who died on each day. People are talking about 1,000 dead and injured together in the past week. And the hospitals, there are nightmarish scenes in the hospitals, as you heard in your segment. The doctors just can't cope. They're not getting any sleep. There's very few of them, only 29 doctors for all those injured people in the whole of the rebel-held part of the city. And it's really turning into a huge humanitarian catastrophe.
Liz, what else is it? Is this it? Is this the end, the climax? Are the rebels going down? Are they being rolled over here? Or is that not clear?
Well, as I think we see, like on those front lines where we're getting some action but not a lot, it actually will be very, very hard to take the city. The Syrian army is tired. They have manpower shortages. They've been fighting for 4 or 5 years. This is a really, really large piece of the city, densely populated neighborhoods, very narrow streets in some places. And the rebels have been there for 4 years. So I don't think anybody is predicting a swift kind of takeover of the city. What seems more likely is just prolonged bombing and slow starvation, which is a technique they have used to take other rebel-held areas elsewhere in the country successfully, but nowhere as big or densely populated as Aleppo.
The punishment coming down very hard, brutally, on Aleppo this week. Charges of war crimes, of barbarism. Liz Sly is with us from Beirut, Lebanon, with us right now as well. And stand by, Liz. From Turkey is Caroline Anning. She's humanitarian media manager at Save the Children. Caroline, thank you very much for being with us. What do you know about conditions inside Aleppo now?
Well, as Liz is describing, it's an absolutely appalling humanitarian situation. It's almost difficult to describe at this point, to find the words. And so there's the indiscriminate bombing, which is terrifying for the children and families that we work with, and also, you know, is creating a situation in which there's a huge number of child casualties and the hospitals are overwhelmed and indeed being bombed themselves. And then on top of that, there's severe shortages of water. The water has been cut off to the east of Aleppo. Massive food shortages. I mean, we haven't been able to get any aid at all into Aleppo for months. And so if there is any food, people can't buy it. They're living on what little they have, which is really, you know, that's going to reach crisis point very soon. So across the board, it's as I say, an appalling situation.
Caroline, who is still in there? And why are they there after so many years of fighting? I mean, it's a city of 2 million. We've got 250,000 or so in the area that's being so brutally bombed now. Why are they still there?
Well, there's a mix of reasons. I mean, in many cases, these are people's homes. This is where they've grown up. This is where they have their lives and their businesses, and they don't want to be forced out. And we as humanitarians don't think that people should be forced from their homes. Unfortunately, we're seeing that happening in other parts of Syria. And people should be able to stay. Children should be able to stay without the fear of being bombed or starved into submission. But also in some cases, they may be the poorest of the poor. They're not able to leave. They don't have the resources to leave. And as I say, since the end of June, the city's been under siege. So we can't get any aid in and people can't leave. Which is very, very difficult, particularly for the medical cases, the severe medical cases that can't be treated there. We can't evacuate them for treatment. So really now people are trapped in this hell in eastern Aleppo.
Have you seen, we've heard for years now, but have you seen in this offensive deliberate targeting of medical facilities?
Well, it's very difficult for us to say whether the targeting is deliberate or not. Certainly the attacks are indiscriminate, and we've seen a huge number of bombs falling, not just on hospitals, but also on schools. I mean, the majority of schools that we support in East Aleppo are actually underground now in basements and have been for a number of years. But with these new bunker-busting underground bombs, even they're not safe. So that's why we at Save the Children really want to see an international investigation into the use of some of these weapons in places like East Aleppo to determine, is it a war crime? Because, as you say, huge numbers of civilians are dying as a result of these indiscriminate attacks.
We heard Ban Ki-moon saying war crime there at an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council on Sunday. This was Matthew Rycroft, British ambassador to the UN, accusing the Syrians and Russians of the same.
Bunker-busting bombs, more suited to destroying military installations, are now destroying homes, decimating bomb shelters, crippling, maiming, killing dozens, if not hundreds. In short, it is difficult to deny that Russia is partnering with the Syrian regime to carry out war crimes.
Liz Sly, that is a serious charge. Does it have any weight? Has it slowed down any of the attacks that are being seen in over on Aleppo?
Well, this is one of the problems. We've had people alleging and complaining and criticizing of war crimes since the beginning of this war, and plenty of war crimes have been committed. But nothing gets done about it. Everybody screams, war crimes, war crimes. But there's very little in the way of any attempt to kind of put pressure on people not to do it. There is no pressure on Russia or Syria at all at the moment to withhold from this behavior. And the diplomacy seems to be dead. And yes, there's certainly plenty of evidence that there are war crimes being committed, because these attacks are indiscriminate, but sometimes they seem very discriminate as well. There were three places were hit between overnight last night. Three places were hit in Aleppo. Two of them were hospitals and one of them was a bakery. And, people there don't believe that this was an accident.
Is there anything on the horizon to stop this? What's the game plan look like, Liz?
The game plan looks like more war and more fighting indefinitely, perhaps until there's a new administration in the United States. The diplomacy pursued so aggressively by Secretary of State Kerry has obviously failed. There's no new talks taking place about reviving that ceasefire. Kerry and Lavrov haven't spoken to each other since they parted company last week. There's no new plan on the table. There's no plan B. Everybody I've spoken to is just forecasting continued disaster.
And Aleppo suffers. Caroline Anning in Turkey, Antakya, Turkey. If this goes on for months more, what consequences for those in Aleppo?
I mean, it's unimaginable to imagine this continuing at the same rate for another couple of months. I mean, people won't survive. We're already seeing dozens of children who've been killed. And so, I mean, it can't, as Liz said, it's incredibly frustrating to watch the diplomatic process, you know, sputter and fail time and again. But I think the international community is going to regret the failure to protect Syria's children for decades to come. And so it's really, really important, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, to find a way to bring about a ceasefire in Aleppo and then to be able to get humanitarian aid in as soon as possible. Because even when they were able to broker a ceasefire a few weeks ago, it only lasted for a couple of days, but it gave people a respite in the city.
Caroline, it's Save the Children there in Turkey. We've got to take a break here. I thank you for being with us. It can't go on, you say. It does go on. Caroline Anning with Save the Children, thank you for joining us. And Liz Sly with The Washington Post out of Beirut, thank you, Liz, as well. We're looking at the onslaught in Aleppo. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the onslaught in Aleppo. Syria's government and Russia bringing the hammer down on trapped thousands in the country's biggest city. Here's the sound of rescue workers pulling a 5-year-old Syrian child alive from the rubble. At first, she looks lifeless. Then you hear her cries. There's a man standing in front of ruins in Aleppo telling the BBC last week he thought that an airstrike nearby was an earthquake.
This morning, we heard an earthquake. Went out and saw a huge hole in the ground. We thought, my God, what is this? What are we to him? Why does Assad hit us like this? May God have revenge on him, that oppressor.
Bunker-busting bombs now being dropped on a city. Here's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon saying that humanitarian aid convoys were suspended after attacks on aid convoys as well.
Just when we think it cannot get any worse, the bar of depravity sinks lower. The United Nations has been forced to suspend aid convoys as a result of this outrage. The humanitarians delivering life-saving aid were heroes. Those who bombed them were cowards.
Russia and the U.S. talked. There was a ceasefire. It didn't last long. Then the bombs came, and they came like crazy. On Sunday, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, had harsh words for the Russian and Syrian government at the U.N. Security Council.
Russia will argue today, no doubt, that these attacks are meant to fight terrorism, and that the people killed in this offensive are terrorists or terrorist sympathizers. This is absurd. What you can be sure that Russia will not do is tell the truth. What Russia is sponsoring and doing is not counterterrorism, it is barbarism. It is apocalyptic, what is being done to eastern Aleppo.
barbarism, apocalypse, big words being thrown around, but also a lot of bombs, and the suffering goes on. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you following the news out of Aleppo? Have you seen the bunker-busting bombs being used on neighborhoods loaded with civilians? Is the world watching war crimes here? And what do you see actually unfolding? What is going on? What's behind what we see in Aleppo? I want to bring in two very knowing voices right now. Clarissa Ward joins us from London. She's senior international correspondent for CNN. Clarissa Ward, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And Noah Bonsi is with us. He is a senior analyst on Syria for the International Crisis Group based in Istanbul in Turkey. Was in Syria last week. Noah, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. Clarissa, what is the dynamic that has brought the Syrians and apparently Russians to bring the hammer down so hard right now on eastern Aleppo? What's driving this offensive?
Well, I think it's interesting, Tom, because the thing that drove the U.S. and Russia to come to the negotiating table was a shared belief that essentially this conflict was not winnable, that neither side could gain a decisive military victory. What is less clear to me is at what point Russia apparently changed its mind and changed course and decided that actually this was winnable, that the regime could win it, and that they were going to double down on their commitments to the regime in pursuit of that military victory. From the beginning, there has been a sense that the U.S. is somewhat impotent in its attempts to try to broker some kind of a more long-term, longer-lasting peace agreement. And that is because, simply put, the U.S. simply does not have any real leverage when it comes to sitting down at the negotiating table and saying to Russia or saying to the regime of Bashar al-Assad, the bunker-busting bombs must stop, the thermite devices must stop, the cluster bombs must stop, the barrel bombs must stop. The U.S. has very little to back it up. And I think there's a certain point where diplomacy is impotent if there isn't on some level the threat of force to give that extra leverage, because essentially what you're looking at now is U.S. diplomats basically asking the Russians nicely to please stop doing this and attempting to shame them publicly. And what we're seeing very clearly is that has no meaningful impact whatsoever on Russian actions on the ground, Tom.
Clarissa, I want to cut through the technical terms here. Thermite, what is that?
Incendiary devices, basically. We've seen multiple reports.
Is that white phosphorus or something else?
There have been reports of white phosphorus. There have been reports of other burning agents, often children getting third-degree burns that continue to burn deep into the skin long after the explosion has passed. As with all of these reports, Tom, it's very difficult to verify them. It's difficult to find out exactly which substances are being used and who is using them. And that is because, of course, you don't have aid workers on the ground, you don't have international monitors on the ground, and you have very few journalists on the ground as well. So it's difficult for all of us to get a picture of exactly what's happening. But what is clear is that war crimes are being committed on a shockingly regular basis, and the international community is just struggling to do anything to stop it.
Noah Bonsi, is Russia now looking for a win here? And what would that mean? What would that look like?
Well, I think first we should all acknowledge it's difficult sometimes to discern the Russian strategy, at least their end game. What's certain is that they see advantage in enabling the regime, along with its allies, Iran-backed militia proxies, to gain significant ground on this extremely important front, the eastern half of Aleppo. I think if you take a step back, the broader incentives of the conflict, there's two real notable things here. One, the costs of Russia's intervention appear manageable. It's primarily an aerial role. They're not suffering casualties on the ground. Manageable costs. And the political gain has been huge. I mean, here we are talking about Russia as if it is a superpower on level with the United States. It, at the moment, as Clarissa points out, is a much more powerful player in the Syrian conflict, which is central on the global stage right now. For Russian leadership that seems to prize the prestige and perception of power in terms of its global role, there's clear benefits here. And as the regime gains ground, its position strengthens politically, as does Russia's in the Syrian context. That's first. And then second, I would note that what we're seeing here, as Liz pointed out earlier, the regime is applying an element of its strategy that it has used elsewhere throughout the conflict for years now, which is basically using massive, brutal collective punishment, indiscriminate bombing that discriminately targets civilians and civilian infrastructure like hospitals, cutting supplies of food and medicine to the point of starvation. It's applied these tactics elsewhere to its advantage. It has gained from applying these tactics around Damascus, around Homs. And it's paid no military or political cost, as Clarissa points out. So if these tactics, brutal as they are, result in military gain, they come with no real political cost, and there are no military consequences, of course the regime will keep doing them. And Russia is simply enabling that on what appears to be an unprecedented scale in Aleppo right now.
But Noah, I mean, this is almost Chechnya-style destruction. Maybe that's what it is. You say they're winning diplomatically just by being a major player here, and that works at home and maybe abroad as well. But what about on the ground? Could they, after all these years of struggle, put the Syrian government in a position to once again actually control all of Syria, or, you know, to push the rebel movement and its many parts into insignificance, or not, Noah?
So that's a big question. And I would argue that ultimately in the mid to long term, that's not sustainable. Maybe they can enable regime gains, but it's very difficult to see how they hold those gains. When you look at the regime's manpower shortage, the regime is so dependent now on foreign fighters supplied by Iran, Hezbollah, as well as Russian airstrikes, to hold ground on the fringes of its territory, let alone gain new ground and rebel strongholds. When you look at where Aleppo is geographically, the supply lines from Turkey are quite short. The population in eastern Aleppo is quite dense. It's very difficult to see how the regime sustains this, even given the amount of support it's receiving. But that's how I see it. I don't think that's necessarily how the regime, the Iranians, or even the Russians see it. And I mean, you bring up Grozny and Chechnya, I think that's key. The understanding of counterinsurgency that we in the West now have from the Iraq experience, you know, the concept of winning hearts and minds, of forging alliances within insurgent communities against the extremist, you know, things we saw in Iraq, the sort of legacy of David Petraeus, I'm not sure that the Russians really buy into any of that. Their experience in counterinsurgency in Chechnya is one that's not so different from the regime's. It entails massive collective punishment. If resistance continues in a city, destroy the city. So I think when we look at why the disconnect between Russia and the United States in this diplomatic engagement has been so serious and so wide, those two different strategies, in terms of how one battles an ongoing rebellion, maybe help explain some of it.
In response, incendiary rhetoric from the West, can we call it that? The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. again sent the Samantha Power here on Sunday, going after Russia and Assad, the Syrian leader.
Instead of pursuing peace, Russia and Assad make war. Instead of helping get life-saving aid to civilians, Russia and Assad are bombing the humanitarian convoys, hospitals, and first responders who are trying desperately to keep people alive.
And again here, the British ambassador to the UN, right alongside Power.
After 5 years of conflict, you might think that the regime has had its fill of barbarity, that its sick bloodlust against its own people has finally run its course. But this weekend, the regime and Russia have instead plunged to new depths and unleashed a new hell on Aleppo.
A new hell in Aleppo. Noah Bonsi, Clarissa Ward, please stand by. William in Missouri, Warsaw, Missouri. Thank you for calling, William. You're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. I'm just fed up with America's inaction, and they don't seem to be listening to Kerry. He's represented what's going on pretty good, and they've got evidence now that Russia is completely involved in this. And everybody's throwing out big words, and I'd like to throw out a small word. It's called war. And I've got 8 children. Some of them would be A1, and I'm just ready to do something, and it's time, past time.
William, I appreciate your call. I mean, there's been a lot of reluctance, deep reluctance, Clarissa Ward. The Obama administration has not wanted to be involved here. And after the Iraq experience, many Americans might understand that. But watching this is difficult. Is there anything changing beyond the rhetoric, in America's posture toward this war, Clarissa?
I think there is a huge amount of pressure on the Obama administration now. If you talk privately to officials in the White House, or former officials predominantly, I should say, various diplomats, there is a really strong sense of understanding that perhaps the thing that will come to haunt the Obama administration for decades to come is the Syria policy, particularly with regards to the kind of crossing of the red line several years ago, which was not then enforced with any kind of U.S. military action. So I do think that in the kind of elite quarters of Washington, there is a cacophony of criticism being leveled at the Obama administration for a perceived, honestly, stubbornness and just a refusal not just to admit that the policy was perhaps flawed, but now sort of a doubling down on that policy and an attempt to make it work. Now, at the same time, I think if you talk to the larger American public, there is a real reluctance, as you said. People don't want to get involved. They're tired of Iraq. They're tired of seeing America trying to kind of impose itself on the world stage. They're tired of sacrificing blood and treasure for wars that they see as unwinnable. And while I do think that that's a very understandable sentiment, it comes with a sort of flawed logic, which is that by not doing anything and pursuing a policy of inaction, that there is no consequence for that. And the reality is the consequences for Syria are huge. It is the giant festering wound that threatens to infect the entire body. And I'm not just talking about Syria, I'm talking about the region. We are now looking at a massive catastrophe in the European Union due to the influx of refugees, which is then contributing to a surge in the popularity of far right-wing parties. We have seen the rise of ISIS, which is a direct product of the chaos and vacuum that was created in the Syrian civil war. So it is naive to assume that just leaving Syria alone and letting these people sort it out for themselves is, in effect, an effective policy. And the consequences of continuing to ignore Syria, I think, and based on many of the people that I talk to, both in government and on the ground, is potentially enormous, Tom.
Noah Bonsa, you've just come out of Syria. Can you see a strategic rationale for inaction here? Or is it inaction, Noah? Maybe, I mean, well, we've got American special forces in there somewhere. What are they doing?
Right. So, you know, I should point out that the part of Syria I was in was very much the part of Syria where you have an American special force as well supporting Kurdish, primarily Kurdish forces fighting against the Islamic State. There is an American role on the ground there, and I think from the White House's perspective, the rationale there is clear, that you know you have a clear enemy in the Islamic State, you have allies on the ground who are willing to fight it and are doing so relatively effectively, although there are a number of difficult to assess costs and risks associated with that. I'll leave those on the side for now. I think I really agree with the way Clarissa phrased it. I think there's consistently been a I think the White House has been very, very strong in assessing the potential risks and costs of any sort of escalated American role. And that's important. That's crucial that they do that, especially given the Iraq legacy. I think where they sometimes have come up short is in gaming out the potential costs, risks of the status quo, which has consistently been beyond their expectations, I think. And I think there's a lesson we need to learn from Syria. It came out in Ban Ki-moon's comments you played earlier. Things continue to get worse and worse, even when we think they can't. And that has happened so many times now in Syria, and you know, unfortunately, I think we should continue to expect this. I will say that ultimately, what the United States will find, I believe, is that this desire to engage in a counter-extremism effort, and a counter-jihadi effort, fighting the Islamic State in particular, the desire to do that in isolation from the rest of the war, as if the rest of the war is something that can be contained by meeting with Sergei Lavrov every once in a while. That's not sustainable. It's certainly not going to address the bloodshed, which is primarily happening in areas held by the opposition, which, you know, and subject to regime onslaught. But it's also not ultimately going to get at the driving dynamics that fuel radicalization and thus support for and recruit for the Islamic State and other extremist groups. We cannot, you know, this perfect world in which we can only focus on the jihadi threat and ignore the more difficult intractable elements of the war itself. It's imaginary. It's not going to lead to success even in our limited objectives. I mean, the United States' limited objectives as currently defined.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the onslaught in Aleppo, Syria's government and Russia bringing the hammer down on trapped thousands in Syria's biggest city. The sound of rescue workers right there pulling two lifeless bodies of children out of the rubble in Aleppo yesterday. Film footage there from the Aleppo Media Center. And we've just seen that repeated again and again and again. Hospitals being hit. Ban Ki-moon just in the last little while here. Today, saying attacks on Syrian hospitals constitute war crimes. Here's Abu Loy, a doctor in eastern Aleppo, that's the rebel-held part, talking with Al Jazeera about the struggles to provide very basic medical care now.
We work even when the bombing is heavy. We receive so many injured people, but there aren't enough doctors. There are just 12 operating rooms in hospitals in all of East Aleppo. The number of people dying in hospital is rising. Because, for example, we have just 10 breathing apparatus, we can serve just 10 patients at a time. The other patients, God help them.
We've got a lot to look at here in this hour. We're going to talk about Shimon Peres, who has died at 93 in Israel, major figure there. There on the White House lawn in 1993 with the Oslo Accords. With us to look at Aleppo, Clarissa Ward, senior international correspondent for CNN. With us from London today, and Noah Bonsi, senior analyst on Syria for the International Crisis Group. He's based in the region, was just in Syria last week, and joins us today. You can join us as well. Should there be intervention here? Should we just watch? Is there a way to make this better? What? Saeed in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Saeed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What claim over two centuries of American foreign policy had on the moral high ground as the advocate for freedom, individual rights, and liberty?
You're going after the United States as Russia is carpet bombing here, is using Chechnya. Why is the U.S. the bad guy when Russia's the one dropping the bunker busters?
Okay. Let's go back and remember our role in the initiation of this. In the early days of Syrian conflict, our ambassador, our last ambassador to Syria, went to Aleppo and stood with the demonstrators. Implication: we are with you. Our Secretary of State and our President both articulated Assad must go. We poured fuel on this fire.
You think the status quo was all right? I mean, Assad was pretty brutal even before all this conflict began. We should have shut down the whole Arab Spring. Is that your point, Saeed?
No, but once we give our word, Hillary Clinton in the debate the other night said our word must mean something. What is the meaning of the word that we gave the Syrian people? It's not just in our inaction now. We are fueling this fire. We transferred $170 billion to the sponsors, to the financial and military sponsors of the Syrian conflict. $170 billion that we transferred to Iran is now supplying the Assad regime to do what it is doing.
Oh, you're talking about Iran, and of course Iran backs Assad in Syria, and I hear you, Saeed. It's complicated. Clarissa Ward, are there still, if the U.S. wanted to be involved, I mean, we are involved, whether we're really actively involved on the ground. We've supported rebels there. Are there still opposition forces, rebels, that would be acceptable both to the U.S. and might present the possibility for a different Syrian future? Or has that been subsumed in Al-Qaeda-related groups, in ISIS-related groups? I don't know. What X-ray it for
well,
us, Clarissa.
Here's what I would say. I would say two things. First of all, I think Saeed is touching on a really important point that I think a lot of Americans don't understand, which is right now in eastern Aleppo, and I was just there in eastern Aleppo in the rebel-held parts a few months ago, and I can tell you, people hate America. They hate America, and they blame us almost as much as they blame Russia and the regime. And
wow.
The reason they do that is because they feel that by doing nothing to protect them from the bombardment that has been raining down on them for 5 years by actively participating or trying to participate in some kind of a ceasefire deal alongside Russia that would end up with the targeting of one of the most successful, albeit jihadist, factions on the ground, they see us actually as being complicit in the war crimes that are being perpetuated in Aleppo. Fairly or unfairly, it is exactly how the Syrian people feel. So make no mistakes, they feel very strongly that the U.S. is not only not doing enough, but by doing so little is actively complicit in what is happening on the ground. Now, you ask about the different rebel groups. First of all, I would say there are more ways that the U.S. can intervene potentially and make a kind of difference on the ground and do something to mitigate the suffering of the Syrian civilian people other than supporting the different rebel groups. When we look at the different groups on the ground, it's clear there is a kind of smorgasbord from the so-called moderate opposition, but most of the rebel groups on the ground that have the most momentum going for them are either Islamist and sometimes extremist. What you have to understand is that this is not because the Syrian people are extremists or because they're terrorists or because they want to strike out across the world and hurt the West and hit the West. It is because in the face of a brutal onslaught, the likes of which we have not seen for quite some time, it was the jihadist factions who were the only people who stepped in to fill the void and offer their hand. And as one Syrian man told me, if you are drowning and you are about to die and there is water coming into your mouth and in your nose and you see someone reaching out their hand to you to lift you onto a life raft, you're going to take that hand. And that is what the Syrian opposition did. It has come to haunt them in many ways that we have seen. But let me clarify also one more point, which is to say, the longer this goes on, the more it drags out, the deeper the resentment and frustration with the international community becomes, the more empowered the Islamists and the extremists become, the more they start to emerge as the heroes on the ground. And Syria is in danger of becoming the most major incubator for extremism and terrorism, the likes of which we have ever seen. And you heard Noah mentioning this idea of tackling ISIS while failing to deal with the Syrian civil war is almost, in a sense, preposterous, because what you have is essentially a terrorist factory being developed in Aleppo, whereby people, when they have seen their entire families crushed by barrel bombs, resort to extreme measures. So the two are inextricably joined together. And so are there a lot of good options for partnerships on the ground? Arguably, there are not. But at the same time, it's important to see the rise in Islamism on the ground in the context of the desperation of the situation.
No, we've just got a minute and change left here. You've been in eastern Syria looking at the efforts to ramp up to go after ISIS. Are these two things related in the American mind? Are they restrained in intervening in the civil war because of their ISIS plans? Clarissa says if the civil war is not fixed, we get more extremism all over.
Right, and to be fair to American officials, I think most of them do understand that the overall dynamics of the conflict are driving radicalization. But they've decided to pick the low-hanging fruit, which is immediate tactical gains against ISIS, and leave dealing with the more intractable elements of the far bloodier parts of the war to diplomacy or to the next administration. On a human level, I can understand, because these are impossible decisions placed before them. I think what we're increasingly seeing, though, is that the easiest battles against ISIS in Syria have been won. Moving forward, the geopolitical and demographic map gets a lot more complicated. And so we've now reached a stage in Syria where relying solely on Kurdish-led forces linked with the PKK to gain ground against ISIS is not going to be sufficient, because of how Turkey views that and the damage it is doing to the U.S.-Turkish relationship, at the extent to which it has brought Turkey directly into the Syrian conflict, bringing troops over the border, and also because the demographics of Raqqa, as well as Al-Bab, key cities remaining in ISIS hands in Syria, are not friendly to Kurdish-led forces. So moving forward, we've really reached a stage where there's going to be continued progress against ISIS, it is going to require a more comprehensive approach to the conflict, at least in northern Syria. I think Turkey will be key here. This is linked to the question of who the U.S. can work with and the sort of spectrum of rebel groups on the ground that Silvis explained. There are a lot of groups with excellent relations with Turkey who do receive support both from Turkey and from the United States. What has never happened in this conflict thus far is really systematic strategic coordination among all the opposition state backers, including Turkey and the U.S., to shift the rebel spectrum to the disadvantage of jihadi forces.
Noah Bansi with the International Crisis Group with us today from the region. It's so good to have you here. And Clarissa Ward at CNN, senior international correspondent there with us today out of London. Our deep thanks to both of you. Thank you, Noah, and thank you, Clarissa, very much for joining us today. In a moment, we will look at the life and legacy of Shimon Peres. This is On Point. Shimon Peres, a major figure in Israel from the country's founding days, has died at 93. He was twice prime minister. He was also minister of defense, foreign affairs, finance, transportation, and Israel's president. Peres grew Israel's defense industry, pushed for development of nuclear weapons there, and tried to find accommodation with Israel's neighbors. In 1993, as foreign minister, he famously signed the Oslo Accords on the White House lawn. We want to think about the legacy of Shimon Peres. Joining me now from New York is Dan Efron, former Jerusalem bureau chief for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, author of Killing a King, The Assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, and the remaking of Israel. It is out in paperback next week in a great book. Dan Efron, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks. Thanks. Hi, Tom.
What has been lost with the death of Shimon Peres?
Well, probably Israel's, greatest visionary for peace. Peres talked a lot about both security and peace as the two legs of his legacy, and you mentioned this in the introduction. He is effectively the father of Israel's nuclear weapons program. You know, he negotiated those deals in the 1950s with the French that helped build Dimona, build the nuclear weapons program in southern Israel. And then 40 years later, he negotiated, or was, let's say, instrumental in negotiating the Oslo Accords with the Palestinians, which were supposed to bring about a lasting peace between Israel and its neighbors, between Israelis and Palestinians. Certainly, I think he viewed his legacy as these two things, as security and peace. Along the way, he did some things that I think he regretted. He was an early booster of the Jewish settlement movement in the West Bank and Gaza that certainly did nothing to advance the cause of peace. That was in the 70s. He cultivated a real rivalry with Yitzhak Rabin, with his fellow member of the Labor Party, that really ended in a kind of Shakespearean tragedy for both of them. I guess I would say one other thing, Tom. You know, part of his legacy is that Peres, for all his achievements, was just unelectable in Israel. And I think that says something about Peres, and it says something about Israelis. But I was counting the number of elections that he contested, that he competed in, during a 20-year period. There were five popular elections. He lost all five, including the one in 1996 after Rabin was assassinated, that really felt unlosable for the Labor Party because of this outpouring of sympathy and support for Labor after the assassination of Rabin. And by losing that election, he probably cost Israel its best chance for peace with Palestinians and with the rest of the Arabs.
I talked to him over the years, a very classy guy. He couldn't win those. On the other hand, he was prime minister twice. The parliament put him in as president for 7 years, and he was president in the teeth of Benjamin Netanyahu's administration. I mean, the Times describing him today as increasingly orphaned, as Israeli society lost interest in accommodation. He was a tough guy and a peace guy, but the lobby for peace seems to have fallen more deeply away, Dan.
There's no doubt in my mind that Israel has moved steadily towards a more hawkish position over the last 20 years, since 1996. In fact, that very election we were talking about, that was the election that brought Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, to the office of prime minister for the first time in 1996. And really, the last 20 years in Israel is the Netanyahu era. He was not, I think he was prime minister for 10 of those 20 years. Netanyahu has managed to move steadily away from, you know, the kinds of things that Shimon Peres wanted to build including some accommodation with Israel, with the Palestinians, including some withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza. I think it was Netanyahu's goal to entrench Israel in the West Bank, and I think he's largely succeeded. And so that idea that Paris and his vision and his ideas became less and less popular in the last couple of decades of Peres's life, I think, is absolutely accurate.
Let's hear his voice one more time. This was Shimon Peres in Tel Aviv last year, reflecting on his work and Israel and the future.
I see only the future. There's nothing else. The past is dead, irrelevant. It doesn't have a future. And even the past you have to reinvent all the time. Because if you discover a new paper, a new escalation, you see that the past was never described correctly. But with the future, we have a problem. The problem is most of us prefer to remember rather than to think or dream or imagine. It's a mistake.
Most of us prefer to remember rather than to think or dream or imagine. If he could still speak, Dan, what would he say to his country, Israel, about the future? What did he think that the more hawkish elements were missing?
Well, I think that statement, that quote, actually captures, you know, Peres very, very well. He was exactly like that. I think in the, you know, he didn't dwell on the past. He liked to talk about the future all the time. And in some ways, that was inspiring for Israelis, but I think also there were periods when he waxed on about the new Middle East. And many Israelis were skeptical, and I think that was one of the things that made him not a popular candidate for prime minister. But you know, he was in the times that I interviewed him, he was a very smart, very inspiring. He was the master of the quip, of the aphorism. You know, he talked about books that he had read. I think he, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, the last interview I did with him, he talked about Daniel Kahneman, the Thinking Fast and Slow. Mm-hmm. He was going to meet Mark Zuckerberg and talked about the information revolution. So, you know, the things that he talks about in that quote are vintage Peres. He always looked to the future, and he was kind of an irrepressible optimist.
And now gone at 93, Shimon Peres there from the earliest days of the country of Israel's existence. Dan Efron is author of Killing a King, The Assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and the Remaking of Israel. Dan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.